Celebrate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Jana, and I'm very excited to welcome you to the 150th episode of the Robots Podcast. Today, we want to take you back to our very beginnings. Some of our most loyal listeners might know that before the Robots Podcast launched in 2008, there was another podcast called Talking Robots. Talking Robots launched in 2006 and was the brainchild of Dario Floriano from EPFL in Switzerland and his then PhD students. Those students then went on to found the Robots Podcast in 2008 and the accompanying Robots Association, a non-profit dedicated to providing free, high-quality information about robotics to the public. After nearly a decade dedicated to spreading the word about robotics, we've grown to include members from around the world. We've launched new projects like RoboHub, which now has 35,000 unique monthly visitors and 500,000 followers on Google+. And we've continued to produce bi-weekly interviews with leaders in robotics. None of this would be possible without our loyal listeners, and we thank you for tuning in for all these years. This is the story of the Robots Podcast in numbers.
Making each podcast takes an interviewer, an interviewee, a news team, a presenter, an audio maestro, a web designer, a social media team, and you, the loyal listeners. All this work adds up to 150 episodes, 6 years of hard work by a team of nearly 20 podcasters, 80 hours of audio, 250 guests from around the world, over 400 news bites, hundreds of topics spanning research, startups, ethics, and art, thousands of followers on social media, 400,000 page views, even more page views through partnerships with main robotics blogs such as robots.net and RoboHub, and millions of downloads. Happy 150th episode!
In homage to our very first episode with Talking Robots, we've brought together the original team for this episode. Marcus, who is now a senior researcher at ETHZ, interviews Dario Floriano, director of the Laboratory of Intelligent Systems at EPFL. Peter, who is now in Japan, will be mixing the audio, as he always does. It'll be fun to see how robotics has progressed over the past 8 years. But first, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Taiwanese technology giant Foxconn, the manufacturer behind consumer electronics like the iPhone, has been cooperating with Google's new robotics division since last year. The revelation by the Wall Street Journal last week follows news of a $10 million investment Foxconn made in a strategic partnership with Carnegie Mellon University last December, and a simultaneous $30 million investment into a high-tech manufacturing center to employ 500 people in Pittsburgh, and earlier news from Foxconn announcing plans to replace some of their 1.2 million employees with 1 million industrial robots by the end of this year. This newly announced cooperation, along with other recent information involving robot manipulation, helped shed some light on Google's robotics plans following its widely publicized acquisition of 8 robot companies last fall. In other news, this week saw 2 more important steps towards autonomous vehicles. The first was a demonstration of the complete Advanced Autonomous Convoy project by U.S. company Lockheed Martin, which showed military trucks retrofit with autonomous vehicles technology successfully driving along dirt roads at high speeds and through urban environments, including tight roads. The demonstration follows recent news of an ongoing search for possibilities to automate tasks like driving with the goal of reducing the size of a brigade from 4,000 soldiers to 3,000 at the U.S. military. This current push towards even more automation technology follows success stories of automation to reduce the number of people in many other sectors of the military, including the Air Force and Navy. The second major milestone was the definition of 6 levels of driving automation by the On-Road Automated Vehicle Standards Committee of one of the world's largest professional transport associations, SAE International. The levels of automation are divided into 2 main parts, with environmental monitoring performed by a human driver for levels 0 to 2, and performed by an automated system for levels 3 to 5. The 2 other main components used to judge the level of automation are the execution of steering and acceleration and deceleration, and the fallback performance of dynamic driving tasks. Under this definition, Lockheed Martin's current demonstration of the complete advanced autonomous convoy would fall into level 3. The system automates all aspects of the dynamic driving task, but does so only for some driving modes and does still rely on a human for fallback. For more information on the cooperation between Foxconn and Google, Lockheed Martin's demonstration of autonomous military trucks, and progress towards driving automation, have a look at robohub.org.
Thank you, Christine. And now let's listen to Marcus and Dario Floriano.
Hi, Dario. Welcome to the 150th episode of the Robots Podcast.
Hi, Marcus. Welcome back. We met last time quite a few years ago in this configuration, right? You asking me questions about robotics for this podcast.
It's been 8 years, I guess, almost, right?
Yeah, 2006. Long ago.
Yeah. So could you nevertheless briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Dario Floriano. I'm the director of the Laboratory of Intelligent Systems at TPFL, and I'm also the director of the Swiss National Center of Competence in Robotics.
So back in 2006, you were the one who started the ancestor of this podcast, the show called Talking Robots at the time. What led you to this idea?
Well, the thing is that robotics had and still has 2 interesting aspects with respect to other engineering fields. The one is that it is a very emotional, I would say, enterprise, meaning that a roboticist typically wants to change the world, wants to recreate the living system, bring so many personal aspects into a project that go beyond the engineering efforts. And these are very difficult to convey, to communicate, I would say, in a technical paper. And so the podcast was the way it was conceived and the way in which I think still today does the job, I would say, is a different way of conveying the whole picture, including this emotional aspect. The other thing is that robotics is a very complex business, meaning that there is electronics, mechanical engineering, artificial intelligence, materials, and so many different things. And it is often not easy for people to communicate in very simple terms what it is all about. And I thought that having a more relaxed and personal way of communicating about this, like a podcast, would help. Also, if we look back at that time, so we're talking 2006, it was a time when robotics was at a situation where the first startups could be created and products could be sold. And so I thought that business was going to be a big thing in robotics, and therefore the podcast potentially could communicate developments in robotics to the business world, so to people who are not necessarily skilled in the technical aspects of robotics.
That's interesting. So I think the podcast has been over many years a project in science communication, and you mentioned one target audience is business, but there's also the general public, and there's other fellow researchers in robotics and engineering as well. Why is science communication important to you?
Well, when we do science or technology, we always do it for something. And I have the feeling that we become so specialized that we always look at our small detail. And it is a good way that we do like that. I mean, it's good that we do like that. But when it comes to explaining to a funding agency or to the journalist who correctly comes to you with very naive and simple questions, then I think that we are not so well prepared to do that. At the same time, robotics is something special in the sense that some of these machines are becoming increasingly more autonomous, and therefore can do things where normally in the past there was a person involved, and now perhaps that there won't be anymore. And it is important to discuss very openly about the consequences of all these things. So communication is extremely important for robotics, because robotics touch so many aspects of society and in such a personal way that many other engineering fields do not.
So we already talked about how the podcast started in 2006, and then a bit more than 2 years after that, in 2008, you decided to step back from your role as chief editor of the then called Talking Robots and to serve on the advisory board of the Current Robots podcast. What led you to this step, and what do you think about the development of the podcast since then?
So I spent indeed 2 years mainly selecting or suggesting to you and Sabine and some of the early persons involved in this podcast names of people who could be interviewed and the topics. And then you were so good, to be honest, and you had so many other ideas that I felt I was no longer probably the best person to drive the whole thing. And also at the same time, if you remember, you were all PhD students in my lab. And I felt at some point the thing had to grow on its own, and so I left, leaving basically more freedom for you to develop this podcast. And I think you have done, you and all the other many people that you could manage to motivate and bring on board have done a magnificent job. And I still listen to the podcast, and I go into your website, the RoboHub. What I think is that you've been very successful at be more comprehensive, have a more varied range of topics that you cover, also much more lively in the way in which it is presented. And you're also much more proactive, meaning that you look at what are the trends and what are the topics, and you also, as a community, you also organize workshops where you invite interesting people. And this is all changing how roboticists think about robots, and is also encouraging the community to think more about communication. So definitely it's a very big success, I think.
We interviewed you in 2012 about your role as the director of the NCCR, the Swiss National Center of Competence and Research in Robotics. And at the time you mentioned that one goal of the NCCR was to bring robots closer to humans. With respect to this goal, was there any particular project that stood out since the start of this NCCR in 2010?
Yeah, in the NCCR, this Swiss National Center of Robotics, we have, I think, approximately 25 projects, and now they've been ongoing for the past 3 years. So it's hard to pick one or two. But indeed, bringing humans closer to robots, or robots closer to human, is our main goal. And I would like to mention two projects, because we have two main axes, two main lines of direction. So one is robots for disaster mitigations, and here we're talking about flying and legged robots, so mobility for outdoor operation. And the other axis of research is wearable robots. So to pick an example, a very recent success story, I would say, in wearable robots is the interface with the neural system. We have invested quite a lot in technology that can read both the activity of neurons with implants and the residual electrical activity on the scalp using EEG. And we've been very successful at interfacing that with prosthetic robotics. For example, just a few days ago, there was this study by the team of Silvestro Micera in Science Translational Medicine, where it shows that a soft prosthetic hand connected to the nervous system of a patient who hasn't his own original hand can give back the feeling of touching objects in an unprecedented way. So the patient was extremely surprised by the feeling of touching and feeling all the texture of these of the objects he was touching, as if the hands was his own. So this, I would say, is a remarkable success story. Another one, bringing robots closer to humans, is, I would say, I pick one from my lab, is the gimbal. The gimbal is a flying robot that gets very physical, meaning that instead of trying to avoid obstacles and humans, because flying robots usually are dangerous, it is caged in a smart cage, I would say. So this gimbal system, where you've got one sphere freely rotating within another sphere. So these robots can move in space and explore the environment and get in contact with humans and bounce off things without very complex sensors. So we delegate the intelligence from the control system to the morphology and to the materials. And therefore, these robots can be in our houses. They can get in touch with us without any danger. So these, I would say, are two success stories of the NCCR. But we have almost 10 years to go, and I hope that will be much more along these lines.
So much more to expect. You're also leading a number of projects in your own lab, the Laboratory of Intelligent Systems here at EPFL. For example, we talked to your collaborators, Ramon Periset and Michal Dobrzynski, in May last year. And we reported on the gimbal that you just mentioned and that you and your collaborators presented at the IROS conference in November. What is the most exciting research project that you're working on recently?
So we have quite a few projects in the lab, and I do not want to offend any of my collaborators by not choosing their projects. But one thing that really excites me is the concept of what I call adaptive morphology as a way for robots to handle multiple ways, multiple modes of locomotion, as we say. For example, you may want to have a robotic system that is capable of walking, of flying, and on even hovering on the over the surface or over an area of interest. How can you handle all of those things at the same time? Now, the typical engineering way of doing that, but there are not so many robots, to be honest, that can do multimodal locomotion, but the typical solution is that you add an actuator for every locomotion mode. Now, when you look at nature, that's not always the case. You have animals that change their shape and they reuse their articulations for multiple locomotion modes. For example, we can swim, we can crawl, we can walk, and we can grab things, manipulate things with only two pairs of articulations. And we have the case of, for example, of the flying squirrel that can climb up the tree and then simply open the spread out legs and then glide downstairs. So if you look at all these examples, what they seem to do, these animals, they change their morphology, their shape, in order to reuse their articulations for different purposes. So in the lab, we have been trying to formalize this concept, what I call this adaptive morphology, and see how we can translate that into engineering design for robots that can display these multiple modes of locomotion. I won't go into the details of the specificities of this thing. It turns out that in some cases it is possible if you respect some constraints. Not always it is possible. And one of the examples that we have of the robots here is called the Daler. That's the code name, which is also the family name of the PhD student doing this. Now, this is a robot that is capable of translational flight, meaning it has fixed wings. It can fly very nicely in the air, and then it can land. And when it lands, it slightly closes at the soft wing, and it deploys the tip of the wings to walk on the ground. And it can walk on the ground in a very agile fashion, very surprising. It can turn on the spot, it can climb over snow piles, it can go into small holes. And so you have the advantage of having a system that can fly very long, over very long distances, say 7 kilometers, 10 kilometers, then go to the ground and then do exploration into near the proximity of where you're interested in. And the next step we are developing is a capability for this same robot to, again, autonomously take off. So upright itself, take off, fly to another location, and then walk to the area it needs to be explored and again to fly. So I find this quite exciting, and I hope that we will have some new results to show in a not so far future.
You mentioned just before that in your lab you do robotics, but also some other things. And as a former PhD student, I'd like to hear, what is the vision behind your lab, and also how has it changed over the years?
I'm very interested in how biological systems tackle very complex problems required by a changing environment. So, we are very flexible, we can adapt very quickly, and yet we seem to use a bag of tricks. And so I'm not sure that there is a unique philosophy or a unique principle or a unique holy grail that I'm trying to catch here with my lab, but I'm exploring the interface between biology and engineering, or how engineering and especially robotics can take inspiration from biology at this interface. Whenever we have a system that can tackle very complex situations, possibly changing, possibly unexpected, using very simple tricks. And I am not so passionate about the reproduction of intelligent systems meant as human cognition, I think it's a very interesting goal for itself, but it's not my cup of tea. And very interesting systems that are relatively simple, can be explained by a few bunch of neurons, if you like, but have very interesting morphologies, very interesting materials, and very interesting coupling between the two.
When we talked back in 2006, you mentioned that in order to get robots to human-level intelligence, we will first need to understand the principles of lifelike intelligence, you called it. And at the time, you stated that the technology in the mechanical and electronic hardware of robotic systems was more advanced than the technology in the artificial intelligence that controls them. Have we made any progress towards more lifelike intelligence? And is your statement about this imbalance between hardware and software still true?
I still think that my statement holds, meaning that today we can build complicated robots that resemble humans and mammals, but still after a few minutes of interactions, even less than a minute of interaction, realize that it doesn't stand up to the expectations of its morphology. And so I still think that there is an imbalance there between the artificial intelligence and the mechatronics. However, I think that we have made steps forward in understanding what lifelike intelligence is. And the achievement that we have made, I think, over the past few years is that we realize definitely that intelligence cannot be considered or studied or developed in isolation of the morphology and the materials. And this is what my colleague Rolf Pfeiffer calls morphological computation, which I think has, over the past few years, translated into a new field of robotics called soft robotics. So we have realized that in order to create lifelike intelligence, perhaps we have to step back a little bit into mechatronics and reconsider how we design these robots. Reconsider the material, reconsider what the role of softness is, because most living systems are soft and flexible. And that has very strong implications for intelligence and control. For example, I believe that the word control for intelligent robots is no longer appropriate. I mean, there is no small homunculus that control a body. What I prefer to use is the word orchestration. There is a very nice balance or orchestration of different endpoints that are in contact with the environment with a continuous sensory feedback. So it's like an orchestra, if you like. They all play together and you just have to, from time to time, direct some aspects so that the orchestra continues to work very smoothly. So I think we have made that step forward, and the field of soft robotics is now growing very rapidly. We will see how far we get, but I don't think robotics will ever end its purpose and its efforts towards creating living systems. It will continue for centuries.
So back in the days of talking robots, we often asked interviewees to predict the future of robotics and tell us in which area robotics will make its biggest impact. So to revive this tradition here, what do you think? In which field will robotics have had the biggest impact on our lives in 20 years?
Okay. I forgot what was my answer last time with the interview. But
I don't remember.
But today, as I stand here, at least what I see, I think there are two fields. One is in the field of wearable robots. One, I think, is going to be the personal enhancement, physical enhancements. It's not necessarily only rehabilitation, but it's just the fact that you may one day have a pair of trousers, jeans-like, that adapt to your morphology and can go with you when you go hiking a mountain. And if you are too tired to come back, they can just gradually feel that and take over the gait, help you your gait, for example. So I think people are going to be quite interested in personal enhancements, and that's a field where I think there will be some progress and products coming out. I think you were there too in Japan at the IREX last year, the largest exhibition in the world of robotics, both research and products. And if you remember, there were so many exoskeletons out there. So clearly there is something happening in that area. The second area where I think that will have a very strong impact is transportation. And of course, we all know about the autonomous cars, and there are clearly things that can be automated increasingly more on the ground, on the pavement, meaning vehicles that can drive autonomously, and probably it's going to be more first in the area of transportation of goods, and then perhaps of humans too. The second thing is that this is going to take off also in the area of robotics. Of course, Amazon have shown recently their vision for flying robots delivering goods. I do not know whether that will materialize, but there are quite a few efforts worldwide. Maternet is one example, very well known. Another one is this flying donkey challenge in Africa, aimed at developing robots with the scientific community that can transport something like a suitcase worth of load over 20 or 50 kilometers, I forgot that. So there are more and more of these events, and there are countries and big companies, logistics, who are interested in this new way of transporting goods without a human on board. And this is robotics.
Thank you very much, Dario, for being here on Robots.
Thank you very much, Marcos. It's a pleasure to be interviewed by you again.
That's it for the 150th episode of the Robots Podcast. We look forward to the future with a new generation of podcasters, which you've had the opportunity to discover over the past several years, including Pear, Ron and Ajang. The field of robotics is continuously evolving, and we'll make sure you get the best coverage directly from the experts. So, as always, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Celebrate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.